Empires once built railways. Today they build algorithms.
Wow, that's quite an opener. It sounds like the tagline for a cyberpunk movie or something.
Doesn't it? It feels so sci-fi. But it's actually a direct quote from the source material we are digging into today, and I think it frames the stakes of this conversation perfectly.
It really does.
We aren't just talking about, computer code or boring regulations. We are talking about digital sovereignty, economics, and ultimately who holds the keys to the future.
And it highlights that the infrastructure of the 21st century isn't steel and concrete anymore. It's trust frameworks, it's verification protocols. I mean, the brutal reality is if you don't control your own digital infrastructure, your own algorithms, you aren't really in charge of your own country, are you?
That is the big question. So, welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're looking at a fascinating collision of worlds. We're analyzing a high-level workshop held right in the Canadian Senate chamber, hosted by Senator Colin Deakin back in October 2025.
And the focus was this massive, and I mean massive, challenge, bridging the digital divide between Canada and the European Union.
And we should clarify right off the bat, when we say digital divide here, we don't mean who has high-speed internet.
No, not at all. We are talking about governance. We're talking about the actual, like, plumbing of trust. How do these two massive jurisdictions with totally different legal DNA trust each other's digital data?
Right. And to guide us through this maze, we have a pretty serious stack of documents. We've got a presentation by Keith Jansa. He's the CEO of the Digital Governance Council, which he gave to the Trust Over IP Working Group.
That was in January 2026. And we also have the slides from that Senate workshop, plus a joint study on digital identity interoperability.
Keith Jansa is a key figure here. He comes from the Standards Council of Canada, so he, lives and breathes this stuff.
He really does. And the mission of this deep dive is pretty specific. We need to understand how Canada and the EU are trying to build this shared digital trust without having to completely rewrite their own laws.
And spoiler alert, the solution might involve something called living laboratories and, of all things, a toaster.
The toaster analogy is genuinely brilliant. It might be my favorite part of this whole thing. We will definitely get to that.
Okay, let's set the stage then. Segment one, The Odd Couple. We've got Canada and the EU. Jansa describes the setting of this workshop in the Senate chamber, and he calls it the place of sober second thought.
Right. He contrasts it with the feisty House of Commons.
Exactly. It sets the mood. This wasn't a political shouting match. It was a deep structural policy discussion.
And the central conflict they identified is just. It's fundamental. You have the European Union on one side, and their model is described as top-down.
Top-down feels like an understatement for the EU sometimes. They seem to have a regulation for, well, everything.
Oh, they really do. They have the IDEUS regulation for electronic ID, the AI Act, the Digital Services Act. It's this, like, super structured, mandatory, centralized regulatory environment.
So if you want to play in Europe, here are the rules, written in stone, passed down from Brussels.
Exactly. It's an empire of regulation. They decide the standard and everyone has to fall in line.
And then on the other side of the Atlantic, you have Canada.
Right. Which Jansa describes as decentralized or bottom up. I mean, Canada's a federation. You have the federal government in Ottawa, sure. But then you have provinces and territories that hold a massive amount of power.
Especially where it comes to identity.
Exactly.
My birth certificate, my health card, my driver's license, those are all provincial. Ottawa doesn't issue any of those.
Right. So the Canadian model is consensus driven. It's a negotiation. In Europe, the center commands. In Canada, the center asks, and the provinces might say maybe or no, or we'll do it our own way. Thank you very much.
So on one side, you have this empire of strict centralized rules. Mm-hmm. And on the other, you have a group of friends trying to agree on where to go for dinner.
That is a charitable way to put it.
Yeah.
But yeah, pretty accurate. And the challenge posed in the workshop was exactly that. How do you get a top-down regulatory empire to talk to a decentralized, consensus-based federation?
It seems impossible.
Well, if Europe says, show me your centralized digital ID law so we can trade, and Canada says, well, we have 10 different provinces doing their own thing, the conversation is usually over before it even begins.
You would think so. It sounds like trying to plug a European power cord into a North American socket without an adapter.
Yeah.
It just shouldn't work.
Exactly. But this is where it gets really interesting. They discussed this joint study by Keith Jansa and Ellis Jonathan Shema, and they found something that, honestly, it surprised me when I read it.
Oh, yeah. What was that?
They found that despite these massive structural differences, the skyscraper versus the sprawling ranch, there are no insurmountable legal, technical, or conceptual barriers.
No insurmountable barriers. That feels counterintuitive given everything you just laid out.
It does. Until you look at the foundation, it turns out both regions align with something called the UN Citral Model Law on Identity and Trust
The
Services.
UN Citral. Okay, that's a mouthful. Break that down for us.
It's the United Nations Commission on International Trade Law. It's basically a global template for how countries should handle commercial laws.
So because both Canada and the EU used this same template when they were building their legal foundations.
The core concepts of what is a signature and what is trust are actually the same.
So the house looks different on the outside, but the concrete slab underneath is the same mix.
Precisely. And that leads us to the magic phrase of this entire deep dive. If you take one thing away from this discussion, it's this term, functional equivalence.
Functional equivalence. It sounds like something a marriage counselor would suggest. You don't have to be the same, you just have to function together.
That's actually not a bad comparison. The core question the source material posed was, does Canada need to copy Europe's laws to trade with them? Do we need to pass our own Canadian IDs?
And the answer is no.
A definitive no. Mutual recognition does not require identical systems. It only requires equivalent assurance and reliability.
So Canada keeps its rule book, Europe keeps theirs.
Exactly. And this is a huge, huge deal because it preserves sovereignty. Canada doesn't want Brussels writing its laws, and Europe doesn't want Ottawa writing theirs. Functional equivalence just means we agree that my process, even if it's different, yields a result that is just as trustworthy as yours.
But how do you prove that? I mean, if I'm a European regulator, why should I trust a digital ID from, say, Saskatchewan? I can't just take their word for it.
This brings us to the toaster.
Finally, I've been waiting for the toaster explanation. I saw this in the notes and I thought, how does a kitchen appliance explain international digital law?
It is the best analogy I've seen for this. So Jansa brings up the specific comparison regarding conformity assessment. He talks about two ISO numbers, 110025 versus 110029.
Okay, I can hear our listeners' eyes glazing over already at ISO numbers. Why do these matter?
Stick with me because this really explains the future of the internet. Think about buying a toaster. You see a little mark on it, a UL listing or a CE mark, something like that. That's product certification. That's ISO 110025. It tells you that this specific physical object has been tested and it won't burst into flames when you make a bagel.
Right. I trust the toaster because of the stamp, but I don't really know how the factory is run. I just know the toast is safe.
Exactly. The mark implies trust, but it applies to the product. You test the output. But in the digital world, where you're dealing with intangible things, data, identity, credentials, that stamp on the product isn't enough.
Why not?
Because software changes every day. An app that is secure today might get an update tomorrow with a bug. You can't just test the toaster once.
Because the toaster keeps changing shape. It's a shape-shifting toaster.
Right. So Jansa argues we need to move toward ISO 110029. This is about validation and verification. It isn't just stamping a product, it's issuing statements of verification about the organization itself.
So instead of just saying this digital ID app works, it's saying we have verified that the company running this app has strict privacy controls, they manage data ethically, and they follow these specific rules.
Exactly. It creates a sort of metadata of trust. You're trusting the chef, not just tasting the meal once. And Jansen makes the point that this data is crucial to combat misinformation. If you have verified claims about how a system is governed, you can counter the narratives that say, oh, this is just a surveillance tool.
You can show the receipt, so to speak.
You can show the receipt. No, look, here's the independent verification that we literally cannot track you.
Which is a perfect segue, because we have to talk about the branding problem. Because right now, if you say digital ID in Canada, a lot of people don't think convenience, they think Big Brother.
Oh, absolutely. The elephant in the room, or as the source material puts it, the chip in the neck.
Oh, that's a visceral image.
It is, but it captures the mood. And this was a stark contrast they brought up in the workshop. In Europe, digital identity is, it's a bureaucratic term. It is listed in legislation like IADs. It's mandatory in a lot of places.
People just accept it.
Yeah, as part of the infrastructure, like roads or water pipes. You need it for government services, so you get it.
But in Canada,
In Canada, the term digital identity is, to use Jansa's words, highly polarized and contentious.
He mentioned some specific fears, narratives about a surveillance state, government tracking your behavior.
And yes, even conspiracy theories about chips installed in the back of your neck. It sounds extreme, but the sentiment is real. There is this deep cultural skepticism in North America about centralized government databases that just doesn't exist in the same way in, say, Northern Europe.
The sense of, why do you need to know this?
That's it, exactly. It's amazing how the same tech can be seen as efficient bureaucracy in one place and an Orwellian nightmare across the ocean.
And there was another interesting cultural difference they noted about driver's licenses.
Oh, right. In Canada, and the US for that matter, your driver's license is basically your life. It's your primary ID. You use it to buy alcohol, get on a plane, open a bank account. It is the card.
Whereas in Europe?
In Europe, a driver's license is often viewed just as a privilege to drive a vehicle. It isn't necessarily seen as a foundational identity document in the same way. Many countries have a separate national ID card.
So if you try to build a system based on driver's licenses, you're hitting a cultural wall?
A huge one. And in Canada, if you try to roll out a national digital ID, you trigger all those surveillance fears because people don't want a national ID. The source material points out that because of this, just trying to roll out a citizen-facing digital ID in Canada right now is a total non-starter.
Politically, it's the third rail. Any politician who touches it gets burned.
Right.
So if Canada can't just roll out a mandatory digital ID because everyone's afraid of being tracked, what's the strategy? Are we just stuck?
No, and this is where the strategy gets really clever. Jansa talks about a pivot.
A pivot to what?
The workshop participants basically agreed. Stop focusing on citizens for a minute. It's too contentious. Focus on B2B, business-to-business, and workplace applications.
Ah, because businesses just want to get deals done efficiently. They aren't worried about the surveillance state in the same way.
Precisely. B2B and workplace applications are described as the least contentious and most impactful early pilots. If a business needs to verify itself to another business, that's just commerce.
And Jansa gives a really compelling example of how to reframe the technology.
The doctor shortage, yes. This is a brilliant example of changing the narrative. Instead of selling digital ID, which scares people, you sell ensuring Canadians have access to family doctors.
Wait, walk me through that. How does digital ID get me a doctor? That sounds like a campaign promise, not a tech spec.
Well, think about the current problem. Canada has a massive shortage of doctors. But there are qualified foreign doctors trained in Europe, for example, who are in Canada right now driving Ubers.
Because they can't get their credentials recognized. The paperwork is a nightmare.
Exactly. The paper-based verification process is slow, bureaucratic. It takes months or years to verify that Dr. Smith from France is actually a qualified doctor.
Ah, I see where this is going. So if you had a verifiable digital credential, a digital diploma or digital medical license from Europe that the Canadian system could instantly trust.
You get doctors into clinics faster. It solves a real painful problem for regular people. And crucially, it verifies a professional qualification, not a citizen's private life. It doesn't trigger those tracking fears because it's about your job.
That is so clever. It's almost like Trojan horsing the infrastructure in through a service everyone wants. We aren't tracking you. We're just helping the doctor get to work.
It's use case driven interoperability. You build the pipes for the doctors and eventually people get comfortable with the pipes. Another example they mentioned was pilot licenses.
That makes sense.
Pilots fly across borders constantly. It makes sense for their license to be digitally readable and verified in both places. Again, totally non-controversial.
And what about the VLEI? That came up in the Q&A. It sounded important, but incredibly dry.
The VLEI is the verifiable legal entity identifier.
You were right. Dry.
Bear with me. It's for banking. Right now, verifying that a corporation is who they say they are across borders is a nightmare. A VLEI lets a company digitally sign regulatory submissions. It's vital for trade. And again, nobody thinks the government is putting a chip in the neck of a corporation.
Hopefully not. Now, the source material also mentioned travel credentials. That seems like a no-brainer. I hate standing in line at customs. Why wasn't that the top pick for a pilot program?
It was discussed, but it was flagged as politically risky. As soon as you involve border services and the movement of people, you're right back in that zone of surveillance and tracking.
Right. Why does the government need to know where I am?
Exactly. Whereas verifying a business is legit or a doctor is qualified, that's much safer ground. The workshop participants endorse these B2B pilots as living laboratories.
Living laboratories. I like that term. It implies experimentation.
It means they can stress test the governance. They can make sure the rules work, make sure the trust is real before they ever try to roll it out to the wider public. It's about building social trust before you scale up the technical trust.
And if the B2B pilots work, you have a case study. You can say, look, we helped the doctors and nobody's civil rights were violated.
Exactly.
Okay, so we have the odd couple of governance, the toaster validation method, and the doctor shortage strategy. But how do you make this legal? Do you have to write a whole new treaty? Because that takes decades.
Thankfully, no. And this is where the bureaucrats get excited. They plan to leverage CETA.
The Comprehensive Economic and Trade Agreement.
That's the one, the big trade deal between Canada and the EU. And inside that massive agreement, there's something called a conformity assessment protocol.
Which sounds incredibly dull, but I'm guessing it's the secret weapon.
It is. Currently, it's used for physical goods. It's the mechanism that says if this Canadian toy is tested in Canada and meets the safety standards, Europe accepts that test. We don't need to test it again.
Okay, so they just want to do that for digital stuff.
Exactly. The proposal is to extend that protocol to include digital credentials and trust services. So if a Canadian trust service provider, a company that issues digital IDs, is audited in Canada, Europe accepts that audit.
That makes so much sense. It grounds this whole cyberpunk future in boring existing trade architecture.
And it cuts compliance costs massively. You don't need to pay for certification twice. It treats a digital signature with the same logic as a physical product. It's a brilliant shortcut. You don't need a new treaty. You just add an appendix to the old one.
So we're nearing the end of our deep dive here. We've covered a lot of ground, from Senate chambers to toasters to doctors. What's the big takeaway for you?
The summary for me is that this isn't a technology problem. JANSA and the study were very clear. The tech works. We can make the servers talk to each other tomorrow. The issue is policy interoperability and social trust.
It's about getting the lawyers and the citizens to be as compatible as the servers are.
Correct. And there was a pretty stark warning in the notes about Kenya.
Yes, that stood out to me too.
They cited Kenya as an example of failed governance despite technology. Kenya implemented a high-tech digital ID system, but the governance failed. People didn't trust it, there were legal challenges, the rollout was botched.
So the system faced a massive backlash.
Exactly. It's a reminder that you can have the best code in the world, but if you don't have the people on board, you have nothing. Tech is not a silver bullet, it's an amplifier. If your governance is bad, tech just amplifies the bad governance.
That leads perfectly to the final thought from Keith JANSA that I wanted to leave our listeners with. He said, don't let technology define governance. Governance should be defining how technology behaves.
That's a powerful statement. It really flips the current dynamic on its head.
It really does, because right now it feels like technology leads and we're all just scrambling to write rules for it afterwards. He used that phrase, letting the cat out of the barn.
Yeah, implying that in many ways we are playing catch up. The internet scaled without these trust layers. The algorithms were built before the railways, so to speak.
We have these massive digital ecosystems that grew up in the wild without any of this.
Exactly.
So the provocative question for you, the listener, today is this. In a world where we've already let the cat out of the barn, where tech giants and algorithms are already defining the rules of our lives, is it actually possible for democratic governance to catch up? Or are we just building nice little fences around a barn that's been empty for years?
That is the question of the decade. Can democracy move as fast as code?
It certainly is. We'll leave you with that thought. Thanks for diving in with us. We'll catch you on the next one.
Goodbye.